Hard Lessons, number 5 in the 1 Samuel series. This is an exposition of 1 Samuel chapter 4, verses 1 through 22. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Sunday evening, November the 13th, 2011.
There are some lessons you just don't want to learn. They're important lessons, they're good lessons, they're necessary lessons, they're valuable and they add immensely to the happiness and well-being of your life, but they're lessons that are painful and difficult. In 1995, I began the year with a brain tumor, and I ended the year with a kidney stone. Needless to say, 1995 was not a good year. The experiences were painful and frightening. But I learned during that year that the stuff I preach is really true. The good thing, the positive thing, the lesson that came out of that painful experience is that God really is who He said He is. And I knew Him. I came to know and understand His power, His grace, and mercy in ways I never would have known it if it hadn't been for that experience. But they are still lessons you really don't want to learn. Difficult and painful lessons. Looking back, it was a great experience. Looking back, it was good. It added to my life, and I benefit from it greatly. I've also discovered that there really is a peace that passes all understanding. That for the people of God, He grants us peace when there's no reason for peace, just as He said He would. Jesus said, "I am your peace," and He promised to never leave us or forsake us, and I came to understand through that experience and through subsequent experiences that He really is our peace. I've learned that there is peace in even the darkest night. I've learned that death doesn't win. The problem is, in order to learn that death doesn't win, I had to say goodbye to people I love dearly. I had to pass through the valley of the shadow of death and experience the loss of people who were dear to me in order to understand that God is real, that He is who He said He is, and that He does what He said He will do. Some lessons you just don't want to learn, but they tend to be lessons that are necessary for us to learn. It was a dark time in the nation of Israel. It was that time when there was no king in the land, when every man did what was right in his own eyes. Moral decay and spiritual corruption were commonplace. The great tragedy is the greatest corruption was found in Shiloh at the house of God. There where those two worthless sons of Eli served as priests. Hophni and Phinehas served as priests there. They did not know God. They treated the sacrifices of God with contempt, and they used the house of God as a brothel. It was a dark time in the nation of the people. All the while, in the midst of all of the confusion, in the midst of all of the chaos, God was at work. And God was raising up Samuel to be a priest, a kingmaker, a judge, and a prophet. God was at work in spite of how it seemed. God was doing His work. God was being faithful, though faithlessness abounded. A man of God came to Shiloh with some news for Eli. It wasn't good news. He was told that God was fully aware of the corruption in the land. God was especially aware of the corruption at Shiloh. And so He said to Eli, "There will never be an old man in your house again. I am coming in judgment against the house of Eli. After all I've done for you, after all the good things that I've done for your house, after all of the blessings that I've given, you've treated me with such contempt. The house of Eli is finished, and I'm raising up another." The prophet also said to Eli, "You'll know that all of this is coming about when your two boys die on the same day. That's the sign that the judgment is beginning." Later, God revealed Himself to Samuel and reinforced the message and called Samuel to be a prophet. That brings us to chapter 4. 1 Samuel chapter 4 is our text tonight. We're going to look at verse 1 down through verse 22. We're going to take in the entire chapter. Let's begin at verse 1. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines, and they encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. Now we're told that the word of the Lord came through Samuel. At the end of chapter 3, we're told that not one of his words fell to the ground, meaning there wasn't anything that Samuel said that didn't come to pass, because he spoke on behalf of God, and God blessed him, and God made sure that his words would be fulfilled. God was speaking to the nation through Samuel. He had been called as a prophet. So the first part of verse 1 establishes without any question that Samuel is the key figure in the drama that's going to unfold in this book. And once the writer establishes that, he takes Samuel and puts him on the back burner. Samuel is the focus. Samuel is the key player in all of this. But forget Samuel for now. That's what he's saying. Because in chapters 4, 5, and 6, there's a new focus. And the new focus is on the Ark of the Covenant. That wooden box that was plated with gold that served as the visible reminder of the presence and of the power of God. You'll remember that they were told to build this box and they were to put some items in it. And the Ark of the Covenant contained the tablets of stone that Moses brought down from the mountain, Aaron's rod that budded, and a jar of manna. Further, on the top of that box, there was placed the mercy seat. And it was there on the mercy seat that the blood would be spilled on the day of atonement. It was an important thing. That mercy seat was flanked on either side by cherubim whose wings were spread out. And so the image is that it looked like a chair or a throne, and that became the symbol of the throne of God in the presence of His people. That became the symbol of the presence and the power of God. And once they moved into the land, that ark was taken to Shiloh, and it was placed behind that heavy veil in the tabernacle, which later became a more substantial structure, the house of God. And it was there behind the heavy veil in the most holy place, and there it rested. Now it's going to become the key focus of the next three chapters. One writer said, so chapters 4, 5, and 6 of 1 Samuel is a lesson in archaeology. A-R-K-ology. Because that does become the focus, the power, the presence of God. It's important because it's setting up some things that are going to happen. And it wants to remind us again of who's really in charge of everything. Then we're told in verse 1 that it was a time of war and Israel was at war with the Philistines. Now, that's not news. By this time, they had been at war with the Philistines for about 200 years. And they're going to be at war with them for at least another 300 years. So it's not necessarily news that they were at war, because they were pretty much always at war with these folks. The Philistines occupied five cities along the coastal land to the west of the hill country where most of the Israelites lived. Their cities were Ekron, Ashdod, Gath, Ashkelon, and Gaza. An important lesson is about to be learned in this chapter. So I want us to look carefully at chapter 1, and here's what I want us to see. 1 Samuel chapter 4 is a potent reminder that God will not be used and is always faithful in fulfilling His word. Two things. God will not be used, and God is always faithful in fulfilling His word. Those are two things you can take to the bank. Those are two things that you can count on. No matter what else is going on, no matter what chaos is reigning around us, no matter what's happening on the world scene, two things you can be absolutely certain of today. God's not going to be used, and God is faithful. That's key to our understanding of our God and our relationship with Him. First thing, in verse 1 down through verse 11, the chapter easily divides in two parts. The first lesson in verse 1 down through verse 11, in times of crisis, serious corruption, and imminent threat, superstition is a sorry substitute for genuine faith. When times are dark and times are difficult, when bad things are happening all around us, superstition is a sorry substitute for genuine faith. Now I know you're thinking, well, of course it is. We understand that. That's something basic. Let's move on to something about... No, I want you to see that a consistent problem with the people of God is that their faith often degenerated into little more than superstition. In spite of the fact that God had revealed Himself to them, in spite of the fact God spoke to them through the prophets, in spite of all the benefits that were theirs, their faith often degenerated to silly superstition. And we have an example of that in this text. The battle is about to begin. Israel is encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines are encamped at Aphek. Aphek is 20 miles as the crow flies west of Shiloh. Ebenezer, we're not sure where that is, but it's got to be close. That's where the two armies set up camp. They're in battle with one another. And verse 2, in a very unceremonial way, tells us about this battle. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel. And when the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when the troops came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." Now, I'm not sure about this, but I think the writer of 1 Samuel went to the Joe Friday School of Journalism. Did you see how he described this great battle? Well, they went up against each other, and the Philistines routed Israel, and about 3,000 died. 4,000 died. Just the facts, man. Pure and simple, they went to battle, they got routed. End of story. And then the Israelites come back, they gather after the battle, and what do? They say, "What happened? How is this possible? How is it that we, the people of God, were defeated? I thought God was on our side. I thought we were in covenant relationship. How in the world did we lose this battle?" Now look carefully at the question that they ask. It is significant. It's helpful for us to get this. They ask, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" They didn't say, "How is it that the Philistines beat us?" They didn't say, "How is it that the Philistines were powerful enough to defeat us?" They said, "How is it God defeated us today before the Philistines?" In their presence. How is it God put us down? Another way to look at it, why did God defeat us today? Now, I want to suggest to you that they were asking the right question. They were asking the right question because they knew it was God's doing. They knew that it wasn't a fluke. They knew that it wasn't because they went up against a superior force. They understood clearly this was God's doing. Because the Israelites did believe in the sovereignty of God. They did believe that He was in control. And so when this happened, they said, "Why did God do this to us?" Of course, my question is, why didn't they wait for an answer? Why has the Lord done this? Then immediately they come up with a plan. But there's another part of me that said, you know, I do kind of understand why they didn't wait for an answer, because they already knew the answer. They knew of the corruption in the land. They knew what was going on in Shiloh. Do you remember when we go back and read those opening chapters when it talks about those worthless sons of Eli and all the things they did? It was an open secret. They all knew about how corrupt they were. They all knew that the priesthood was corrupt and they had contempt for the things of God. And they were doing what was not lawful for them to do. They knew that they were taking more than their share in the offerings that were given. They understood that. And they knew of the treating of the women in the temple in the way, or the house of the Lord in the way that it was being done. They knew it was wrong. So maybe part of the reason why they didn't wait for an answer is they knew the corruption of Shiloh. They knew that you can't walk in disobedience and rebellion and expect God to bless it. So I'll give them credit. They had some insight. They had some understanding. That's a good thing. The problem is, what they did with their knowledge. Look at verse 3. Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. Now that sounds good. What is the Ark? The Ark is the symbol of the presence and of the power of God. But look carefully at what they said. Let us bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh, that it may save us. They're engaging in some rabbit foot theology. The leaders, the elders of the people, those who are supposed to know better, those who are supposed to give guidance to the people, they said, hey, somebody go get the good luck charm. Let's bring the Ark up here in our midst. We'll take it with us into battle, and then we can't lose. What's the problem? The problem is they are seeking to use the power of God. Not trust in the power of God, but to use the power of God, that it might save us from our enemies. Now, maybe I'm being too cynical when I refer to it as rabbit foot theology, but it's clear to me that they are seeking to use the power of God, and that's a problem no matter how you spin it. No matter how you try to twist that, no matter how you try to put it in the best light possible, it's unacceptable. At the very least, they're saying, let's go get the Ark and bring it up here, and if we take that into battle with us, then God is obligated to deliver us. They knew it was God who defeated them. They asked the question, why? And their solution was not to deal with the sin in the camp. Their solution was not to deal with the corruption at Shiloh. Their solution was, let's put God on the hook. Go get the Ark and bring it up here, and we'll take it into battle with us. God will have to deliver us, because if God does not deliver us, it's going to look bad for God. If God doesn't deliver us, if He doesn't bring us through, if we're defeated again with the Ark of God there, that's the presence of God, then God's going to look bad. He can't afford to look bad. This will be the good thing for us. Now that's putting the most positive spin on it that we can. It further reveals the corruption of the people. Let's not deal with our sin. Let's not deal with what we know to be the problem. Let's try to bypass it all, and let's try to harness the power of God for our own benefit. Now, lest you think there's not a lesson in this for us, let me just ask you to think. Is it any different when a businessman all of a sudden decides he will pray that God will save his business? The motivation of the prayer is, if the power of God can turn my business around, then I will see the value of God. If not, I don't see there's any value in it. Or how about the person who is sick, who all of a sudden wants you to pray? Prayer's never been a part of their life. Prayer's never been part of their regular experience. They've never sought the will of God in their life. They've never sought for God to give direction and guidance. But now they're sick, and so they say, well, let's pray, and if God heals me, I'll see the value of God. But if God doesn't heal, I don't think there's any real value here. Or what about the student that says, it's time to pray because I got a test? I don't pass this test, it could be real trouble. What's the motivation? Why are we praying? What is our real concern? What about the parent who all of a sudden is begging the church and everyone they know to pray for them and their wayward child? Is it really any different from what Israel's trying to do at Aphek? Trying to harness the power of God and use it for their benefit. I don't think it's any different than what they were doing. And you and I had better hear this lesson. We had better consider our own heart carefully. Because if we're not careful, we're going to find ourselves singing the wrong song. If we're not careful, we're going to start singing, "Thou art useful. Thou art useful. Thou art useful, O Lord." Instead of singing, "Thou art worthy." It's dangerous when we allow our faith to slip into silly superstition. Is God powerful? Yes, He is. He spoke and the world came into being. He holds all things together by the power of His might. And our God intervenes in the real world where you and I live. And He brings healing and He brings strength and He brings peace and He rescues businesses. He does all kinds of things like that. But when we seek to harness His power for our own benefit, we're on dangerous ground. Bring up the ark of the Lord. Because if it is in our midst, it will deliver us. Well, let's see what happens. Verse 4. So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts. Fuller description, because the writer is wanting us to really understand what the ark was. It really is the symbol of the power and of the presence of God. The ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. Now, it's a disgusting picture given what we already know, this last line in verse 4. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. The two worthless sons of Eli, those two degenerate priests, were the ones who brought the ark up. You beginning to see there's something really wrong with this picture? Verse 5. As soon as the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. They brought the ark into the camp and everybody, "All right! Yay!" And they yelled to the point there was just like thunder across the valley. And the earth shook because of the great shout. They were excited because the ark of God was here. Our good luck charm. Here He is. Now we're going to win. Now there's no way we can lose. Look at what happened to their enemy. Verse 6. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid. For they said, "A god has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us! Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." The Philistines were afraid because they had respect for the power of the God of the Hebrews. Oh, we've heard the stories of what their God did to the Egyptians. They were the most powerful nation on earth. We know what that God did there. Woe to us. That's a term of judgment. That's a term that literally says, "I'm falling apart. I'm disintegrating. This is awful." So we're poised for a great victory. The people of God are encouraged. They're shouting with great joy. They know they're going to win. The Philistines are sure they're going to lose. They're trying to buck up the troops. You got to be men. You got to fight. And the implication is we're going to lose, but we got to fight anyway. Verse 10, so the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and they fled, every man to his home. And there was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers, and the ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. A tragic lesson. A very great slaughter, 30,000 died. Only 4,000 died the first time around. They brought up the good luck charm, and now 30,000 died. Not only did 30,000 die, the army ran away. And they didn't go back to regroup, they ran home. And the ark of God, the presence and power of God, was captured by Israel's enemy. You know what that tells me? That tells me God will not be mocked. God will not be used. And apparently, God isn't really all that concerned with what the Philistines think about Him. He's going to deal with them starting in the next chapter. See, they were sure they were going to win because God couldn't afford to have His reputation tarnished. But see, when you're the sovereign King of the universe and you created everything and you rule supremely over everything that exists, you're not all that worried about your reputation. God was less concerned about His reputation among the pagans because He had a lesson for His people to learn. A great slaughter. They ran away, and God was captured. That's what it meant to them. Can you imagine? In times of crisis, serious corruption, and imminent threat, superstition is a sorry substitute for genuine faith. Instead of dealing with their problem, instead of dealing with the corruption, instead of dealing with their sin, they sought to harness and to use the power of God, and God's not going to be used. Lesson one. Second, beginning in verse 12 down through verse 22, even in the midst of chaos, judgment, and confusion, God is at work fulfilling His purpose. Now, the first 11 verses of this chapter are tragic, but the last half is pathetic. I mean, it's just awful. Look, beginning in verse 12. A man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day. Aphek is how far? 20 miles west. And on the same day, this man had run 20 miles to bring news from the battlefield. With his clothes torn and with dirt on his head. Now, Eli is not the monster that his sons were. He really wasn't. But he didn't do anything to stop the corruption. He didn't do anything to intervene. And the picture that we're given here in this passage is of an old man sitting at the gate. He's blind. In fact, we're told that he's 98 years old. That's in verse 15. And yet he's sitting and looking down the road. Blind, but looking down the road. and his heart trembles. And here comes a man from the battlefield, his clothes torn, dust on his head. Now, don't think of that in terms of, man, he was in the thick of the battle. He's been wounded. His clothes are all torn up because of the battle. These are signs of mourning. What do the Hebrews do when there's death? Tear their clothes. Put ashes on their head. 30,000 Israelites died that day. They ran home, and the Ark of the Covenant, the most precious possession they have, is in the hands of their enemies. If you're sitting waiting for news from the battle and you see a man running towards you, his clothes are torn, he has dust on his head, it's not good news. So he comes running with the news. Eli was sitting on his seat by the road watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. Why? Did he know something? Was he fearing something? Was he remembering the prophecy that was given to him by the man of God and later by Samuel? I don't know. For whatever reason, he's trembling. He's worried. He's sitting in the gate. Here comes this man. He came into the city and told the news, and all the city cried out. When Eli heard the sound of the outcry, he said, "What is this uproar?" Then the man hurried and came and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, "I am the one who has come from the battle. I fled from the battlefield today." And he said, "How did it go, my son?" He who brought the news answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines. And there has also been a great defeat among the people. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And the ark of God has been captured." As soon as he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy. He had judged Israel 40 years. Death reigned, not just on the battlefield, but in Shiloh. Beginning with verse 19, we hear about Mrs. Phinehas. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she vowed and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman attending her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer or pay attention. And she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel." Because of the ark of God has been captured. Because of her father-in-law and her husband. She said, "The glory has departed from Israel. For the ark of God has been captured." Death reigned in Shiloh. It's a depressing chapter. It's a depressing section. All told, 34,000 dead soldiers. A dead high priest. His two sons, also priests, dead. A woman dies in childbirth. And a kid gets named Ichabod. It's a bad day in the life of the people of God. So the question is, what good can come out of all this? How is there anything good in such a chapter? I think it's this: God is at work. God is at work, and He's fulfilling His purpose. He's cleansing the priesthood of corruption. He's preparing the ground for the ministry of Samuel and later David. God is at work in the sorrow and the heartache as well as in the joy. He's at work in the good, the bad, and the ugly. God is still sovereign, and His purpose cannot fail. See, that's the message. That's the truth. Rest assured, God will not be used, and He is always faithful to fulfilling His word. In times of crisis, serious corruption, and imminent threat, superstition is a sorry substitute for genuine faith. And even in the midst of chaos, judgment, and confusion, God is at work fulfilling His purpose. That's the God we serve. And it's just as true today as in the days of Samuel. This is our God. And we would do well to learn this valuable lesson that we really don't want to learn as Israel had to learn it. Let's pray together. Father, I thank You that You are gracious and kind, that You are merciful and loving. And even in Your judgment, there is mercy. Even with all the death and corruption in this chapter, You are at work. And it all serves Your purpose. Because You are holy, You will purify Your people. Because You are holy, You will honor Your name. Because You are holy, You will not be mocked. You will not be used. So, Father, teach us this truth. Teach us this truth that we might guard our heart against the sin of presumption and the error of allowing our faith to degenerate into superstition. And help us to know Your purposes cannot fail. Your will is going to be accomplished in the earth. And every word You've spoken will come to pass. Grant us courage. Grant us faith to believe and live to Your glory. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.